Okay, this is the 14th session. It's August 22nd, 2006. It's part one, side one, and you've got the nice little synchronous 2214 there. 14th session, and it's 22nd day of August. 2214 is a ratio on my chart. Okay, so we're going to pick up where we left off several sessions ago with McLuhan. We're on page 21. How far did we get with LaRouche? Did we get to page 24 with LaRouche?
We got to page 28. The bottom of page 28 is where we're going to pick up on LaRouche next time.
Okay, so we're back on page 21, so we got to catch up on the McLuhan side of the book, the right-hand pages. And McLuhan will go all the way to page 47 on the right-hand side, and LaRouche goes all the way to page 84 on the left-hand side. LaRouche gets a longer stretch. LaRouche goes to page 82. Okay, so, and then Croker starts on page 84 on the left-hand side, and Thompson starts on page 49 on the right-hand side after McLuhan's finished on page 47. So we're undoing 21 right-hand side, McLuhan. So a quote we did on page 21 at the top, we're just going to transition by reviewing it again. I'll read it since you've read it before and we've been through it, right? Okay. It says, "For the dominant environment of our age has itself become information or, quote, software. Since at electric speed, any figure is in italics, tends to become ground, and ground's italicized, and anything, however trivial, can acquire infinite mass. The temptation and the desire to gamble with everything and anything becomes obsessive. $1 at the speed of light can do as many transactions as a million at pre-electric speeds. Quantitative projections and rational critiques cannot cope here." This is from McLuhan's op-ed with Barry Nevitt for the New York Times, September 21st, 1974, 32 years ago, and it's on page L29 in the New York Times of that issue. Now, the idea that a dollar bill becomes equal to transactions worth a million at pre-electric speed is a pretty interesting idea. One thing about this quote, "For the dominant environment of our age has itself become information or software," and he has software in quotes. See, why would he have software in quotes? He talks about the hardware in other books, the hardware environment and the software environment. I think he puts it in quotes because it's referring to content of media. And content is maybe what normally people think of as software, but software is also a word for programming, a technical term in computer industry. And so since there's the software environment, which is the computer televised environment as a form, or the electric environment, would be software not capitalized. So he says, "For the dominant environment of our age itself has itself become information or software." He's talking about content has become form. They've merged. And this is confirmed by the next sentence, where he says, "Since at electric speed, any figure tends to become ground." Figure, italicized, ground, italicized. They merge. Mm-hmm. "And anything, however trivial, can acquire infinite mass." See, if we're moving at the speed of light under electric conditions, and then there's normal older media as its content, now that's pretty amazing that time and space are obsolesced by the electric environment. Now, the content acquires that dimensionless form. You see what I'm saying now? The dimensionless, non-space and time aspect of the electric simultaneity.
Yeah,
the content becomes merged with that formal fact, and therefore it becomes dimensionless, and therefore the dollar acquires infinite mass. Follow the logic there?
And then back to the logic there. Is it impossible to have a figure in a situation where every figure becomes ground?
McLuhan spends this whole op-ed, that's why it's so important. It's post-understanding media. It's post, it crystallizes aspects of Take Today, which came out in 1972, which may not have been noticed. This person who article. He wrote back just today that he got the article, and he said, when I read it, I remember reading it in the archives in Ottawa, and I thought, oh, it's just summation of a take today, but now that I really read it closely, I see there's some important points in there that go beyond what I thought. So that person found it really significant, and one of the key points is this thing about the dollar. Now, McLuhan does a tetrad on Bucky Fuller's law of etherealization.
Uh-huh.
And he says, when figure becomes ground, the figure flips into becoming a monster. Now, inflation is a monster. And so he says, when a figure, everything is a figure, what is the ground? The ground is public attention. And public attention is what everybody's fighting for. And that's where the word makes the market, which is a phrase he uses in this op-ed. That's the only place I think he uses it. The word makes the market is where the Android meme or the White House has to focus the ground of attention. Everybody's focusing, fighting over what the ground looks at, right? So it's a battle over, the cliche version is it's a battle over the minds of men. But it's literally involved with the nature of the electronic environment, which is merged. And
the concept of ground, the concept of ground disappears if the concept of figure disappears.
That's right. They merge. And everything is just figure. He says on page 11 of Take Today, I imagine I've got the quote in here somewhere, or maybe I already did it. Did I do the one where McLuhan says man is both figure and ground in
no.
the present environment? Now, I don't know if it's in the book here, but that's an important quote. You can look it up on page 11 of Take Today. He says that the present conditions, when he's writing this book, early 70s, is such that man is both figure and ground. You know, it's not TV is the ground, computer's not ground. Humans, the user, the human inventor, the human content, and this is where the phrase user as content came from, it becomes both figure and ground. So he's talking about that here. So the ground becomes public attention. And so this may be a general reason why the National Enquirer level of news that is spread into the dominant old-fashioned Walter Cronkite media of news. And even Cronkite started complaining in the 90s about the disgrace of journalism, how it was just dealing with trivial stuff. Well, you got to deal with trivial stuff because if you can focus public attention on something that's really serious, like what we're talking about, and then everybody gets all involved in it. And that can create quite a chaotic whatever. It's like, and this really gets into the point that the White House will never announce that we've made contact with ETs or we discovered a cure for AIDS, unless it is really studied and programmed, because when you have the power to focus the public attention on something which becomes ground, a monster, and affects every other transaction in the world, that's what he means here. $1 at the speed of light do as many transactions as a million transactions at pre-electric speeds, or as a million at pre-electric speeds.
Well, now, the way that I think about that probably isn't the way that you mean it, but like, for instance, if I have a dollar in my wallet and I go out on the street and I go to the store, there's any number of things that I can use that dollar to buy or to make a transaction. On the internet, there's infinite number of things that I can buy or transact with that dollar, because all the stores in the world are every item that's possibly for sale is available to me to spend that dollar on.
Yes, like if you are charged monthly $29 a month for using the internet, and $1 is one day, $29, 30 days a month. So on one day, you spend $1 for your internet bill, and look at all that you can do in that day.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're doing, you think of the wealth that went into building all these environments. Whereas before you had, if you're lucky, a newspaper, 100 years ago, you walked to the store on your horse, and if you could do a lot 100 years ago, if you were a wealthy Rockefeller and you had $1 million, you could do a lot of things compared to the average person. But those things that the Rockefeller could do 100 years ago are puny compared to what the average person on welfare can do with the internet, $1 per day. That's the point. The number of you can do as many transactions as $1 million could do for you at pre-electric speeds, and that means involve a lot of environments, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could be a hacker, and you could hack the Pentagon, and then hack some site and get a bunch of hamburgers or something. You could do all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
You're discarnate. You're a super angel. You're interacting all over the place. So this leads to the Enron problem of when they get to a certain level of power or utilities, they're beyond the measurement of it, money, and they don't have any money anymore. That's why on the books, which is still an old medium, which is still interacting with all the other media, the accounting medium, they had to give themselves loans and call it profits just to make sense in a visual space terms, but in actuality, they didn't need that money anymore. They just were in a position to move utilities, and shut them down and turn them on and have brownouts like in California.
Right.
So this is important. He's getting at. There's something very strange here, and this is the key to inflation. This article goes on to explain inflation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it's called disequilibrium economics.
Yeah. And but this applies to this philosophy applies to people who are in a position to turn on and off environments. The average guy like me, you know, I don't have that ability to turn on and off. You know.
Well, you're in.
I can't create a brownout in Los Angeles.
You get the effects of it.
Yeah.
You end up in a world where 30 years ago you would only need one-fifth of the number you need of the amount of money today just to get by. So you're a victim. You use the computer and you use Walkmans 30 years ago. All the things you've used, you didn't know that they were accumulating and would end up where your whole culture is outsourced and your job security is limited. You've been inflated in terms of all the environments around you and in terms of what you were. So, you know, the disservice is that you lose everything. And it's because you're engaged in this society with that kind of technology.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they'll train you and give you jobs and mick jobs and fake jobs and sitting around being a shepherd to media. So quantitative projections and rational critiques, the old Keynesian economics, the Marxist economics, what was called equilibrium economics, does not work in the speed of light, computerized environment, which leads to disequilibrium economics and all the problems you've heard about for the last 25 years.
Right.
In terms of economies, they just aren't rational anymore. Remember Alan, what was the guy, Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve, he said, we're in a period of irrational exuberance.
Mm. That could mean different things. That could just mean we're overly optimistic.
It was his way of trying. He probably hadn't thought it out, even though he was the part of the word that makes the market. Rational exuberance is another way of saying disequilibrium economics, where the global economy becomes a gambling casino, and everything is inflated.
Yeah,
and crashes at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a very strange, chaotic environment.
Well, you can make a tangible argument for the global gambling casino with anybody gets on the internet can gamble now. They can go to a gambling website and gamble their money on whatever scale they want to, or they can get into the derivative market.
Yes.
You know.
Now the derivatives are a big deal by the early 90s. McLuhan is writing about that, predicting the effects of the derivatives. He talks about the playing with the tactile gap between a moment now and a future. You get some money, get the interest in several hours, and then invest it. That rapid speed up of the virtual economy, the tax derivatives economy, that's what this article op-ed addresses.
Right.
Way ahead of everybody else.
Right.
Very interesting.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is for the guy who knows how to do that, he can leverage that, and that's true in his reality. For the average guy who's just getting a paycheck and trying to figure out how to balance his checkbook at the end of the month,
he ends up having no money. See, the point is here is that he buys a new computer. He likes he sees a Super Bowl ad in 1984 that Mac put out, Macintosh, you know, the Apple put out, and buys a computer, starts word processing, and he doesn't know that that's going to create an economy that's going to evade his job, lead to 30,000 people, you know, downsized at General Motors and all the stuff that's happened since then.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he's affected by it, but in affected ways that he doesn't foresee.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks the computer is progress. And if you don't know what it's going to do to you and how it's affecting you, then it isn't progress. It is chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it is progress if you understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people at different levels of the economic ladder that use it and are victims. I mean, many people were arrested for stealing money, ripping off things through the digital white-collar crime. There were many people murdered, knocked off. There were intelligence wars. All that happened in the 80s due to the fact that everything became figuring ground, became a monster.
Mm-hmm.
So that article also goes into how the tactile mesh of the TV screen becomes a figure for economic manipulation. So the pulsating dots of the TV screen become Marshall's metaphor for the pulsating digital pulses of the global economy.
Uh-huh.
And the futures market, and investing in the tactile gap. We're moving past the TV tactile image into something new, which makes the tactile image a figure, and therefore an interval that leads to the gambling casino. So this article in the New York Times is a beautiful article, and I often talk about the post-tactile, and this is the article that proves that I'm not making it up. McLuhan discusses the post-tactile and how it becomes content.
This was 1974.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on to the next quote, which is from Renaissance magazine, which was a journal in the 50s, a Catholic literary journal. And there's some good literary criticism. McLuhan writes about Joyce and various things. He stuck some of his media analysis into the literary reviews. It's an interesting mixture of his sort of scholarly interest plus his media analysis. So this one is from page 166. Of the summer 1962 issue of Renaissance, and that's R-E-N-A-S-C-E-N-C-E. It doesn't have the word I after A, as Renaissance normally does. So it's R-E-N-A-S-C-E-N-C-E, an article called Phase 2. So you want to read what he says?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're jumping back 12 years from the previous quote to 1962. He says, Joyce knew that any technology is at once internalized by men with a resulting shift in the ratios among their senses. This shift is recorded exactly in the tones and colors and interplay of words. Language is itself the very drama of cognition and recognition.
Or recognition.
Or recognition.
Now, we've been doing quotes on the global theater of the 60s and early 70s, the mixed corporate media world. You know, doing the gambling casino and the instant replay, later McLuhan stuff. Now we're going back to 62, and we're going to have a series of quotes talking about the mind itself, or the drama of cognition, or how people perceive things, because it was that drama of cognition, which is what McLuhan says was extended by television, or the electric environment, the extension of the central nervous system. So we're looking at the sensory constituents of the central nervous system and how it creates perception. So I've shifted to another theme here. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Gone dealing with, you know, global markets, and then now we're talking about the drama of cognition. So this is the next section of quotes. And
Now, in other quotes, heard you use in the past the phrase the stages of apprehension. Are stages of apprehension and the drama of cognition the same thing?
Pretty well, yeah.
Okay.
The stage of apprehension was more of an aesthetic thing in his art criticism 10 years before the early 50s. But he did talk about the drama of cognition, but he was talking about the cognitive agency of a human being, like an individual's brain. And he would call it a mixture of senses. But he moves to the macro level of the TV extension of the stages of apprehension, and he starts referring to the drama of cognition and recognition as applied to the collective TV
mm-hmm.
environment. So we should actually do the next two quotes and then relate them all together. So the next one, and then we'll go back and discuss all three and four. The next one is from, you look up the code at the back, IL, Interior Landscape, his literary criticism. So this is page 32 that would probably be an essay on James Joyce. Let's read that.
They are the representatives of the age-old adequation of mind and things, enacting the drama of the endless adjustment of the interior acts and dispositions of the mind to the outer world, the drama of cognition itself.
See, there we are again. I'll just read that. I'll read the first one, the previous one. Joyce knew that any technology is at once internalized by men, with a resulting shift in the ratios among their senses. This shift is recorded exactly in the tones and colors and interplay of words. Language is itself the very drama of cognition and recognition, or very drama of cognition and recognition. Then the other quote, they are the representatives of the age-old adequation of mind and things, enacting the drama of the endless adjustment of the interior acts and dispositions of the mind to the outer world, the drama of cognition itself. So you see, you have the word interior acts, and then before that, the previous quote, internalized by men. So you have this, this is the making where the human takes in the sensory data, makes it, adjusts it, mutates it, and then throws back an image on the world that is distorted by the human cognitive process. So it's not just a matching with external reality. Part of it's matched, but there's also the making part. It's almost like the mixing of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. So this, the important point is to understand the interaction of the inner tactile sensory apparatus with the external world, and then how that's going to be mimed by the electric technology. So you come to the third quote, which is from Cliché, the book from Cliché to Archetype, and it's page 14. You want to read that quote?
Yeah, 1970. The outer trip has been specialist and Western. The inner trip has been ecological and oriental. Both kinds of trips are cliché probes. It has its own methods, and
each has
its own methods and preferences of retrieval from the rag and bone shop of past experience. The outer trip prefers to retrieve antiques or archetypes. The inner trip prefers the probing cliché world of the module.
Yeah, that was the outer trip prefers to retrieve antiquities or archetypes. Now we've moved to the more collective drama of cognition, and you get whole cultural differences between the East and West. And the West is in...
Losing your voice here.
Oh. Now we're getting in this third quote from page 14 of from Cliché to Archetype, published in 1970. You have the larger reference to the West versus the Orient or the East, and he says the East is inner trip, that's the collective drama of cognition stylistically, and the Western is in outer trip. So we're moving to broader landscapes from the first two quotes, which are more just like the human individual body and its interaction with the interior and exterior world in making perception, or what he called the drama of cognition, right?
Mm-hmm.
And remember the instant replay. If you go back up at the top, the quote we did, second last quote we did last McClone session, it says, is not the instant replay the externalizing of the cognitive principle itself? For the replay would seem to offer both cognition and recognition. So I've laid that out above. Then we had the global economy quote about the $1 million inflation dollar being equal to $1 million. And now we're back explaining the drama of cognition, which relates back to the instant replay statement. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm doing here? Now, the next quote, the fourth quote, is from Cliché to Archetype again, page 20. You want to read that? Okay, but let me read the previous one on the fast pace. Cliché to Archetype, page 14. It goes, the outer trip has been specialist and Western. The inner trip has been ecological and oriental. It doesn't have ecological, it has ecological, E-C-H-O. Both kinds of trips are cliché probes, hyphenated. Each has its own methods and preferences of retrieval from the rag and bone shop of past experience. The outer trip prefers to retrieve antiquities or archetypes. The inner trip prefers the probing cliché world of the module. Okay, so we said that. Now let's read page 20 of the book from Cliché to Archetype.
Language is a technology which extends all of the human senses simultaneously. All the other human artifacts are by comparison, specialist extensions of our physical and mental faculties.
Right. Now, that goes back to the four quotes back, which the Jews knew that any technology is at once internalized by men, with the resulting shifts in the ratios among their senses. That's similar to him saying that all the other human artifacts are, as opposed to language, specialist extensions of our physical and mental faculties. So we have...
Well, to distinguish what he means by language, sometimes when he uses the word language, I think he's talking about media. But in this instance, I think he's talking about speech as opposed to media.
Yes, but it's speech which, when someone is talking to you, all the senses are involved. You're smelling them. You're watching them gesture. It's not written speech, not written language. It's the interaction with the person.
Yeah, when I think of speech, I think of them, using your mouth to talk to somebody.
Right, and you don't think about the gesture, even though your mind is absorbing the effects of the gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And judging it, but you focus on the mouth. So, yeah, he's saying that language is not... It's not just acoustic. It is tactile. It involves all the senses simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that quote, and in the previous quote, he talked about antiquities or archetypes, and he mentioned the cliché probe. We're going to come up in the next few quotes, this whole dialectic between cliché and archetype, and how the cliché deals with the world of the module, and the archetypes is the world of antiquities, in the rag and bone shop of past experience. So we're setting up a thing here where the dram of cognition is going to become the relationship between cliché and archetype, that the interaction between, in the drama of cognition and recognition, the human taking in sensory data, creating ratios out of it, the technology determining the ratios on top of the senses, all that interplay is going to be reduced to what McLuhan called the interplay of cliché and archetype. So that's what I'm leading up to.
Yeah. So, when we're talking about cliché and archetype, have we scrapped the previous notion that we discussed called from cliché to archetype, which is a four-part process, last word, cliché, art form, and archetype? Now we're dropping out cliché, we're dropping out last word and art form, we're just talking about the interplay of cliché and archetype?
Yeah, and that's a very important point you've raised. In understanding media, written, almost 10 years before cliché to archetype. And he says the book Cliché to Archetype goes way beyond understanding media. So you look at understanding media, and that mainly gets up to TV and then does a little bit on automation. It doesn't really talk about the global theater. Satellite is like the hidden ground that he leaves out when he's dealing with understanding media. Understanding media is dealing with all the pre-satellite media as art form, and he addresses them almost like a poet. But the ground of all that, that turned all the previous media into an art form, is the satellite. So the satellite is the ground of the technique and method of Gutenberg Galassi and understanding media, which came out in 62 and 64, respectively. Now, after the satellite environment in the late 60s, you have the beginning of the instant replay. That's why I put the instant replay in there up above before we get into this stuff about the drama of cognition, because that's post-satellite, and that's creating a whole new metaphysical quandary for humans, where they have the meaning before the experience. All that has led to the process of a new technology being the last word, and then it becomes a cliché, then it becomes an art form and an archetype, that four stages. There's so much intermedia on a macro scale happening in the global theater, and there's no more new media to be made after the satellite, since that's the final extension, right? Extension of not just our bodies, but the whole planet. After the satellite, it's the interplay of all the media that we've invented. And so there's no more last word. There's no more...
Well, the Internet comes later.
Wait, no, we'll get to that.
Okay.
There's no more last word. There's no more new media environments. No more extensions, okay? We've extended the final thing, the satellite. But once the satellite's there, then it's the interplay of the satellite and all the previous media, which were extensions of our faculties, inner and outer. It is that that I call the macro tactility of the 60s. Remember we talked about that earlier?
Mm-hmm.
Television is a tactile medium in itself. It extends tactility. But the interplay of all the media after the last medium, the satellite, is a macro tactility, which leads to no more new media no more last words, and no more art form phase, because in Understanding Meeting Gutenberg Alsi, he talks about how the book made speech in an art form, the movie made the novel an art form, television made movies the art form, that kind of sequential thing. There's no more art form sequential process other than that the satellite makes the planet into an art form, leading to ecology. So that's why we drop art form and last word. And it's good that you noticed that, because then we come reduced to cliche and archetype. And as McLuhan said, the computer creates a two-bit world. We're now post-satellite. We're into the instant replay. And in the increasingly in digital automation, which is what I call the Android meme, which swallows up everything before. So you say the Internet is a new technology. Yes, but I say that it's technology taking on a life of its own. McLuhan may not
The interplay of the media evolving and becoming even more merged.
More conscious, like our human faculties. The dram of cognition is the integration of all the senses by the tactile function, creating coherent consciousness. So that's why humans have coherent consciousness, or a lot of mammals have. It's a cohering of the interplay of their sensory faculties. Now we must look at the interplay of media environments themselves. As they shrink and get digitalized, they acquire consciousness like the human brain did. Follow that?
No, I would say they mimic the consciousness of the human brain, but I think it's, I don't even know if it's debatable if it actually becomes a conscious sentient.
Well, that's an ongoing dialogue. What was the fantasy of the 80s? The Japanese were going to create fifth-dimensional computers and call it artificial intelligence. The effect of the interplay of these macro environments and the shrinking of them and the becoming of a human scale in the whole my holopathic process, what I call it the holopathic process, people thought that machines were going to take on a consciousness of their own.
Yeah, remember how? How appeared to take on a consciousness.
Yeah. That was the dream of 2001. Well, this became a part of millions, billions of dollars invested in the search for artificial intelligence. Now, that is an effect of this macro interplay in the global theater, and then the next phase of digitalization is that humans think, oh, maybe we could create machine consciousness. But I would say that they actually were living within a machine consciousness, not exactly like human consciousness, but yes, you could say it's a miming of consciousness, but it's affecting humans and our consciousness, and it's taking on a life of its own. And the way I lay out these articles, these quotes, is I'm leading to that. I've laid out the instant replay, which is post-satellite, and it's going to create a weird metaphysical situation. Then I retrieve the dram of cognition to remind us what we are, then show how that gets reduced to a cliche archetype interplay, and then that becomes a miming of human consciousness, and then we get into the upcoming quotes. But overall, it's a means of trying to get this point across through these almost aphoristic-like selections from McLuhan. So the reduction of the last word, the elimination of last word and art form, now becomes cliché to archetype. And the book Cliché Archetype is all about, he has on the inner book flap, he says, old cliché becomes new archetype, and old archetype becomes new cliché. He plays with it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so he's going to develop the tetrad later, but we're in this phase of the early 70s when automation is like the term for the interaction of satellite computers, TV, and everything. Because as the digital starts, the Internet starts hooking up in September 69, they start making, DARPA starts hooking up computers, and they start talking to each other. And that factor is a model of the reduction by Western man of the computer world to the two-bit wit. And McLuhan said this was a biased use of computers and would lead to an impoverishment of life, which many people feel has happened under computers. Digital computers, not mainframe analog computers. And
mainframe computers were digital. Computers have always been digital. from the start. Even when they were using vacuum tubes, they were
right.
Digital.
If you look at it closely, but there is the transistor, and then the technology came after the transistor, was something new that the guys in the 40s never predicted. Somebody was saying to me the other day, McLuhan was way ahead of his time because he told them that computers would not become bigger. He told IBM they'd become smaller. They didn't believe that back then in the 60s. They thought they were going to get bigger and bigger. But the process of getting smaller is what I mean by digitalization. My actual term is homeopathic. But the shrinking of the computer environment was not foreseen by the 40s and 50s guys.
Yeah.
And the transistor was the big breakthrough, right?
Yeah.
And then the semiconductor comes after that.
Mm-hmm.
The semiconductor leads to even tinier situation. And so that tinier process is what I mean by digitization for a general term, as opposed to the vacuum cube circuits of the computers of the 40s.
Yeah.
The vacuum tube,
yeah.
You know, those big bulky things.
Yeah. Solid state's another term used for the...
For the earlier or the later?
No, for the later tech, the later...
For the semiconductor phase.
Semiconductor, yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, they were big bulky things, and yes, they were zero and one, right?
Yeah.
Switching on and off. That was the big...
Right, that's digital.
Yeah, and so I'm perverting the traditional use of that digital, the way you say digital, and digitization is like the...
I think digital refers to the binary code, one and zero. I think that's what digital is, and computer code has always been, you know, digital on-off binary code.
Right, but it...
But then when they had the... first they had these big computers that worked with, like, vacuum tubes... Yeah, which produced a lot of heat, and they stored the information on magnetic tape, and they probably stored it in an analog form. And then the circuitry became more solid state, more silicone based. Then they got rid of the vacuum tubes, they got rid of the heat, the circuitry became smaller, and eventually they started storing digital information on digital media, you know, discs. Tapes and discs.
Right, so you have a new technology altering the definition or the situation, which goes back to that quote from the New York Times op-ed. He says, for the dominant environment of our age has itself become information or software, and software is in quotes. That's almost an indication of the process of the first the transistor, then the semiconductor, then the solid state. All these refinements of compression, it's hard to make a general term for it. And
beyond that, you know, once they compressed the circuitry down to where it got smaller and smaller, then they started finding ways of compressing the code itself, so that if you had, you know, 1,000 lines of code that had to go through, you know, run through all these little transistors and semiconductors in order to be processed, they found algorithms that they could use to compress 1,000 lines of code into 25 lines of code, you know, and so that also helped to speed things up.
Yeah, it's like the whole electronic form of the computer industry was going through mutations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through software code and shrinking. And that's what McLuhan didn't use the term, but I call that homeopathizing, because once you're able to have this new compressed situation and you make products out of it, people, the effect of that is that people living in the information that comes out of that, and that's a hologram. But the agency of that hologram is getting tinier and tinier. So there's the homeopathic term, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's homeopathic and hologram in its effect. As Windows 95 becomes Windows 2000, you know? It leads to faster, and then you bring in DSL and speed, bandwidth and all that stuff. The whole mixture of all that is just creating faster and faster, more instant and instant, but we've already been instant for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
relatively, right?
Yeah, information travels at the speed of light. It's virtually instantaneous.
Yeah, there's a plane going over, just a second. What did you say there?
Information travels at the speed of light, even over a telegraph wire. It's virtually instantaneous.
Right. So we're always staying in the same instant situation, but we're refining it.
Yeah, because we go from the telegraph, where you're just transmitting
letters,
Morse code, to the internet, where it's still instantaneous, but you're transmitting television and radio and text and, you know, everything.
Yeah, and it's like this quote, the last one we read, language is a technology which extends all of the human senses simultaneously. The internet becomes that definition. The internet is a technology which extends all of the human senses simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts to take on the character.
We can, at very least, we can say it mimes consciousness. It's debatable as to whether it becomes conscious. I did hear a computer expert guy saying about, with respect to all the automated processes going on the internet, that they're becoming so complex that these automated processes are outside of the control of human intervention, and even to some degree the ability to predict the effects of automation. The automation is beginning to take on a life of itself. Automated processes are beginning to create automated processes with implications we don't fully understand. That doesn't mean it's becoming conscious or self-aware, but it's certainly mining consciousness.
Okay, think of consciousness as when consciousness itself is hard to define, but you know it when you interact with another consciousness. And language is the medium for translating yourself into someone else. It's like he defines the process of cognition is mined by language, and the process of cognition is the enacting the drama of the endless adjustment of the interior acts and dispositions of the mind to the outer world.
Mm-hmm.
That's the drama, the adjustment going in and out, in and out.
So is the internet doing that? Is it adjusting itself to the matrix of the world in which
Yes, because it's two-way communication. You send an email to someone, and then they can send something back to you. So it's approximating conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And conversation is a speech form of language. If you're in person, it's multisensory. But the basic fact that you can say something and then that life form interacts back with you, that is what one-way media got mutated from into two-way media. So the interaction of the internet life, instant messaging, is very much like conversation, and that's the essence of humans.
Uh-huh.
And machines are taking on those characteristics.
Sure. And machines, are automated to talk to each other. I mean, when a machine is automated, you know, it's set up on a schedule at, 5 p.m. every day. It sends messages to some other machine on the other side of the planet. That machine sends back an acknowledgement that it received those messages. And those messages may have something to do with the synchronization or the coordination of those machines, which human beings may never really even bothered to take a look at. They just have it set up to do that for some reason.
Yes, so that is all media mime our senses. So the miming of humans interacting is being done by the machines. They're miming the interaction. And it can't, they definitely don't look like a human being, but aspects of our cognitive drama of cognition, our cognitive process, is being done and mimed by machines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point. That's the anti-McLuhanites would call that the mimetic fallacy. Too much emphasis on mime. But if you're pro-McLuhan, you make a big deal out of the mimetic process.
Mm-hmm.
Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
So
and then there's the sort of Croker area where you venture into the idea of the simulacrum.
Yeah.
Where you're not really sure whether it actually appears real, but it's beginning to become questionable as to whether or not you're in real dialogue with a sentient creature, or you're just talking to a machine, or talking to yourself.
Yeah, now simulacra comes from Baudrillard. Croker replays Baudrillard, but simulacra, to me, is the effect of the macro-tactility of the 60s. Satellite environment with computers, TV, newspapers, and everything that's going on in that global theater, that creates, in effect, a hologram, a collective impression that's called the news, which is registering the effects of things. That is another way of describing Baudrillard's simulacra.
Mm-hmm.
These are macro environments people live in,
right,
and have to respond to, and the simulacra has to respond to the human.
Mm-hmm.
It does respond. Human inputs. So If McLuhan's saying the computer reduces the world to a 2-bit world, then he mimed that at the height of the computer period of 1970. This is the semiconductor transfer phase, transistor phase of the computer. Then he takes the four levels of last word, cliche, art form, archetype, and reduces it down to an interaction of cliche to archetype. And then it's interesting, later he then expands it to the four again. You have the enhancement, the obsolescence, the retrieval, and the flip. But in this period of what some of us call the 70s as the blandout, not the freakout decade, but the blandout, it's been blanded out by the stage of computers at that point, which is a 2-bit width of 0 and 1, and the use of computers for bureaucratizing government and education and tourism and everything, which alienated a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like Orwellian, or it seemed too much of an automaton world and homogenized the world too much. You know,
right.
all those old complaints, right?
It's pre-artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is trying to take that bureaucracy and somehow make it so user-friendly that it feels like you're dealing with, an organic being as opposed to a mechanized system of bureaucracy.
Yeah, friendly fascism or user-friendly.